This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. So I saw what I thought was a pretty interesting story on Twitter this morning. It appears that Seamus Khan from Columbia University had his ethnographic field note subpoenaed. Did you hear about this?
Yeah, I saw it on Twitter this morning also.
Yeah, I mean, so, I mean, this is out of my subfield. In fact, I'm not really even a qualitative sociologist, but like, this sounds like a nightmare if you were an interviewer.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think this is really a worst case scenario, save for something horrible happening while you're in the field, right?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, for sure. Like, an in real life problem is definitely the worst. Barring that, this is quite bad.
Yeah.
So here, I'll give the background of the story for our listeners. So Khan was doing an ethnography about an elite prep school, right?
Yeah.
And there was a sexual assault case involving the school, and his field notes were subpoenaed. Do you have more details on this? Do you know more about
this?
No,
I don't. I just saw the tweets. I haven't looked into it yet.
All right. So anyhow, he said something. He said he offshored his notes to some place where he couldn't access them on the advice of a lawyer. That sounds weird. I'm not going to get detained on that.
Yeah.
But like, not all of his research relevant material was secured away from the courts. Like, his emails were available, right?
Yeah.
He probably had notes sitting around the office. Uh-huh. And so he had to basically fight.
Yeah.
Gabe's here.
Okay. Yeah.
Hello?
Gabriel, we're recording now. Just whatever. Come in.
Hey, how you doing?
Clayton's on with us.
We've been desperately bullshitting and killing time, hoping somebody else will call in.
Sorry, Gabriel is dropping in for a moment, but he can't stay for long. Got a meeting or something. You got something big planned, Gabe?
Well, much bigger things than you guys.
All right, so I'm going to finish this story, and I don't know where I left off, but anyhow, okay. So Khan says like he offshored his notes to some place where he couldn't access them on the advice of his lawyer. And then, but the courts were still able to requisition some of his materials, right? Like emails, notes, whatever was lying around the office. And he wanted to fight for the confidentiality of his subjects. And he had to get lawyers. And it cost him money.
Like, what is the lawsuit actually about?
Oh, it's about a sexual assault that took place at the school.
Oh, okay. Well, then this makes sense why people want.
Yeah, that's it makes sense, right?
Yeah.
So, and it's a serious crime. It's a serious court case. So practically, Khan proposes four solutions. Well, first of all, wait, before I get into it, what's your take on this? Like, any takes on Seamus Khan getting sued for his notes?
Well, I mean, I don't like it when my friends get sued. you know, and it's tricky, right? I mean, because it's a very similar issue to journalists. And some states have journalistic shield laws. And you can see that there's a real conflict where, on the one hand, you know, we want to have the right to keep our things confidential. And some professions do have the right to keep things confidential. You can't subpoena a priest. You can't subpoena a psychiatrist. You know, and in some states you can't subpoena a journalist, although in others you can. So it's kind of an issue of like professional boundaries. And one way that professions establish their professional status is by, you know, granting themselves confidentiality rights. So it's kind of a professionalization story in some ways. But, you know, there's an obvious conflict there, which is that the parties to a lawsuit have rights. I mean, let's say that you're a defendant in a case. You know, the law grants you the right to marshal evidence in your defense. And so it can come into I don't know whether it's the defense or the prosecutor who's subpoenaing Seamus's notes, but let's just say for the sake of argument, it's the defense. Like, let's say that he wasn't able to subpoena Seamus's notes. This is going to inhibit his right to mount a legal defense. And, you know, in general, American courts are designed to, you know, give the benefit of the doubt to the defendant. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a serious conflict, and it's not one. And in saying that, I'm not saying like, oh, definitely Seamus should have to, it's over. I'm just saying that there's a trade-off there, and we should recognize the trade-off, even if we ultimately say, yeah, go get that NIH certification and make sure that the general counsel is going to stick up for you and all that sort of thing. And I think Seamus is absolutely right to take the position of whether or not the defendant or whoever it is who's subpoenaing his notes has a legal claim on them. I don't want to say right to them. You know, confidential subjects also have a right to confidentiality. And, you know, ultimately it has to be hashed out in what I imagine is expensive litigation.
Do they have a right, though, really? Like, I understand why a priest, well, priest less so given my, but like, I understand why a psychologist or a doctor wouldn't be compelled to testify. Do you think that sociologists' work or social scientists' work is so sacred that we should be given those types of, you know, privileges?
Well, that exactly gets to what I was saying about it. It's kind of a professional status issue of is the profession high enough status to be granted special rights that impinge on the rights of other people in society?
Or is the work we do so valuable that it overrides, for example, a crime victim's?
I've done far too much peer review to think that most work in sociology is that valuable.
You know, I think it's the question of, is it that valuable? And, you know, the question of, you know, the, like, you know, identification of status by a third party. Do other people view it that valuable? I would be shocked if they do. But I don't know if I can entirely verbalize why I believe this. But, you know, I mean, obviously the first place I went to was journalism as well. And I do think part of the practice of ethnography, like journalism in most places, is a right to protect your sources. In terms of the moral obligation, I'm not sure, but this is what people are signing up for when we talk to them. I think if we do not have that right, we've certainly been suggesting to people that.
Yeah.
There's certain things that I forget what it is, but I know there's certain contracts that basically say we're not going to reveal this unless we're subpoenaed and then we have to. Like, I forget what contract is, but I saw a contract recently that basically had that language in it. And, you know, we could just add another paragraph to the IRB form that nobody reads, you know, that explicitly says this is confidential unless under court order.
Yeah. You know, I think that would, I agree. I think it could. I think this gets really sticky with people studying, you know, let's say, you know, a criminologist doing ethnography, right? You have vulnerable populations and people engaging in illegal activities. I think that's really where the rubber hits the road of like, how do we professionally identify and what is our role in the field?
Yeah, and this is a classic issue. I mean, it's not like this case with Seamus is the first time this has ever happened. When I was an undergrad and I was taking qualitative methods, we read John Van Manen's The Moral Fix, where he was doing a ride-along with some cops and he saw them beat up a homeless guy. And then the homeless guy's attorney found out that there was a researcher present in the car and subpoenaed his notes.
Well, there you go. That's a fantastic example of the type of situation where I think many in our profession would sympathize with, you know, the person who's requesting the notes. And well, I mean, in this case too, I mean, it was a sexual assault victim. So it's a very complicated issue. I know that, you know, were I advocating for someone who was sexually assaulted, I'd be like, well, who gives a shit about, you know, what's happening at any school, you know, in terms of elite status, like somebody was assaulted. On the other hand, there's a potential that if you start doing that too much, you chill the advancement of knowledge. Like, you know, you prevent science from being advanced.
Well, and there's also another way to say it, where it's like, let's say that there's five people at a party and there's a credible rape accusation, you know, occurring at the party. You know, normally any one of those five people could be subpoenaed and required to testify in court. So why is it any different if one of them wants to turn into an AJS?
Yeah.
It's a little bit different from, say, a confession in a Catholic church or a psychiatric session where the person knowing it is kind of a speech act. You know, it's not like so if a priest is at a party and he directly witnesses a crime being committed at the party, that's not covered by the seal of confession. And the priest could be subpoenaed to testify. It's only if you go into confession and you tell the priest, hey, I did a bad thing at this party, Father, that the priest can't be compelled to testify.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important distinction too, where putting myself in that situation, I would be more comfortable being compelled to testify than my jottings from my ethnographic observations submitted into evidence, right? Just because that's not, like, from a legal perspective, those are records of what happened, but I think anybody who's been out in the field and, like, taken jottings, there's a lot of bullshit in there. Right. Like the purpose of a jotting is to just take notes down and go back and then reconstruct from a bunch of nonsense what actually was and what actually happened. Right. And I don't think the legal system has the sensitivity to understand that.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, and there's also a whole other set of issues, which is that there's another tension between your duty to defend the trust of your field informants with your duty to have replicable and credible research. And, you know, so I forget how long ago it was, like 3 or 4 years ago, Alice Goffman faced a series of accusations. Or, I mean, there were some people who didn't like her book because they had almost like ideological problems with it. And then but in the course of that, you know, they found what were plausible accusations of empirical problems with the book.
Yeah, I remember that.
And Alice wasn't able to defend herself because she'd burned her field notes in order to avoid eventually being subpoenaed to, you know, by some DA to testify on attempted murder or whatever.
Right.
And
did she get in trouble for destroying evidence or?
No, I don't think you can be in trouble for destroying evidence if it's not yet. I think as there's no open court case, it doesn't count as destroying evidence.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so, you know, so if you get a note saying you could be subpoenaed, it'll attach to that. It'll be saying, you know, you have to maintain any records relevant to this case. But before you get that note, burn away. I mean, otherwise the law would basically require all of us to be hoarders.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So wait, I want to read. So Seamus has some guidelines, which he published in Social Forces. I mean, it's great to have a line in the Vita, but like, it's kind of behind the paywall where not everybody can enjoy the fruits of this very important advice.
I think he'd rather not have that line in the Vita.
I know. Litigation. Like, why not put it out on a blog post? You know
the
what I mean?
The most expensive line he's ever gotten.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, that's for
sure. This makes author fees look like nothing.
Yeah.
In any case, here are the four solutions he recommends. Now, number one is apply for and utilize the NIH certificate of confidentiality by asking health-related questions during your research. Number two, he proposes establishing a task force that develops guidelines for ethnographic research where the issue of confidentiality and breaking it comes up, and gives us something that we can give to our subjects as part of the informed consent process. Number three, he thinks that organizations like the ASA should lobby to make confidentiality a condition of research. Something that university council should be defending. And number four is to socialize the cost of subpoenas so that if somebody gets hit, they're not hit. Somebody gets subpoenaed, they're not, you know, damaged personally in a financial way. What do you think of these recommendations? Sound interesting? Any qualms?
Well, so the one about the ASA pushing for this is not in keeping with the ASA's mission, which is to never do anything serving our professional interests, but only, you know, chase after fireflies and shiny objects. But and then this issue, there's a more serious issue with the socializing cost thing, which is it creates a moral hazard problem. You know, so over time, you would expect to see the insurance pool get more expensive. Because if currently people are scared away from doing projects that are likely to result in litigation, once they're insured, you'd see people doing more, you know, litigation. Now, I mean, nobody knows that when they're studying a prep school that there's going to be a rape and they could be subpoenaed on that. But, you know, you do know that when you're studying gangbangers that, you know, I mean, if you're hanging out in South Philly or no, Central Philly, wherever it was, with a bunch of gangbangers, you know that you're probably going to witness some crimes. And, you know, to the extent that becomes more likely, it could, you know, it's, by the way, I thought of another case where, did you guys read Kimberly Huang's article in the summer ASR on bribery in Vietnam?
Yeah.
I did not.
Yeah.
There was a cool bit in the methods section where she said that she had to switch from participant observation to qualitative interviews at one point because the university general counsel warned her that she was in danger of violating the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So that's a law that says that Americans can't bribe foreigners. And right. even if it occurs overseas, you can still be prosecuted in U.S. courts. And, you know, she ran it by Chicago's general counsel, and they warned her that by doing participant observation or even some types of interviews, she would be culpable in some sense.
Not legal.
Yeah. Either. And so she had to completely cut any kind of participant observation and switch to just interviews. And in fact, I think if I remember correctly, there were even some questions she couldn't ask them. Like she had to ask things like on background rather than specific cases. I'm not sure about that. I know she had to stop participant observation, but it seriously constrained her methods. And it's not like I think like, you know, Vietnam would be, have the business practices of Sweden if it wasn't for Kimberly Huang personally going in there and destroying its business culture.
Right.
But that's kind of the implicit assumption of the law. And she had to engineer around that with her ethnography.
Well, it's like also we're not special. We're just normal people, you know, like we're not as important as we view, you know, what we do.
Yeah.
We still have to adhere to the law, and like we're not, you know, we're not so critical to the American system that everything will fall apart. So they have to, you know, carve out special laws for us, I guess. But
so
go on.
One thing I found, this could just be my naivete, but so Seamus was paying out of pocket for this. The way he wrote about it seemed like he was, but if he's employed by the university under IRB, like essentially doing work for the university out in the field that's approved by the university, that it would go to anybody but the general counsel of the university, I find surprising.
Organizations love to be indemnified, you know, and from the university's perspective, they could view this as we have an employee acting recklessly. Now, I mean, being in a place doing a completely ordinary approved ethnography and it's a complete surprise to you that something horrible happens is not really reckless. But, you know, from the university perspective, let's say that Seamus got in a car accident on the way to the field site. Does that mean that the university should pay the damages of the person who he hit with his car?
Well, also, more practically, like the lawyers who work for your university are working to maximize whatever is in the interest of the organization they represent, right? And like, it's they're doing their duty in making you maximally liable and the institution not for any type of brush with the law. Like the universe, your employer is a counterparty in these situations. So is your union, by the way. Like. The only lawyer that you have representing you is the one that hires you. So I would say even if I think under any circumstances, you should always hire a lawyer, even if the university, quote, is providing you with one.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, even just going by Gabriel's example, I mean, if he's approved under IRB and it's at his field site, according to the university's own definition, he is not engaging in anything reckless. Right, if he has IRB approval, like that clause has already been.
You have to view this as a matter of like coercive isomorphism. To a first approximation, so if you walk into the administrative building of your university, and you look at the plates on the door, if you sat there and thought about it for an hour, you could realize which office of the state this office in your university is meant to liaise with.
Sure.
So. You know, the Title IX office, it's right there in the name, is designed to make sure that they don't get in trouble under Title IX.
Yeah.
The IRB office is there to make sure they don't get in trouble under the NIH Common Rule. There's no office. The NIH is not there to, I'm sorry, the IRB office is not there to make sure that you don't get in trouble under state courts with subpoena power. They're just there to make sure that you don't piss off the NIH.
Or that they're not, and, that the university isn't responsible for not putting in procedures that try to ensure compliance, I think, is how I would
put it. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you just got to view this in terms of, this is like a very strong case for neo-institutionalism.
Yeah. So yeah, and I do think that, you know, so I, what is this third recommendation is that the IRB should be protective of scholars also. I mean, I think that is the one to probably advocate for. I mean, only speaking for our IRB, you know, they seem to love nothing more than mission creep. Mm-hmm. So pushing them in mission creep in this direction, I think could be useful to everybody.
Oh, I think it would be terrible. I mean, I don't like having, I mean, right now they just make you check off and saying like, no, I'm not dealing with, you know, vulnerable populations and I'm just going to ask people questions. Giving them one more thing to be afraid of, you know, it might help in these few cases where that problem does occur. Yeah. But for the most part, it's just going to create another 8 pages of paperwork and another month of delay.
Okay. I feel like I'm already getting those.
Yeah. It can always get worse.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.